Me, but also you. The Pharaoh fast-forwards his favorite foreign film, Powder Donut. Okay, what's my line?
The only line I see here on the script is get options based on your budget with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive.
Oh man, that's a tongue twister, huh? I'm sorry, I'm gonna need a few more minutes. Bulbous Walrus, the Bulbous Walrus.
The Name Your Price tool, only from Progressive.
The owl ran afoul of the comatose coxswain.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is Kim Meyer, host of Choose to Rise. Thanks for listening to the following broadcast on Public House Media.
Welcome to Caught Listening, a brand new episode of Caught Listening, the baseball show that goes beyond the white lines. Christian Heimel here with you, as we do every single week, part of the Public House Media Network. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, review, share us with your friends and family this holiday season. You can find us on every platform, pretty much. Amazon Podcast, Google and Apple Play, of course, Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, Spotify, and publichousemedia.org. This will be the final show of the 2020 calendar year, a year that I'm sure many of us are excited to say farewell to. And we will continue on and end the year with our In Memoriam series here, focusing on a gentleman, again, a lot of legends of the game lost in 2020, but one for really kind of epitomized a franchise more than maybe almost anybody else who has passed this year. Obviously, you do have some incredible folks such as Lou Brock, Joe Morgan, Whitey Ford, but I'm not sure how many people epitomized a franchise and are still revered by not only the fans of the team, but the franchise itself as Tom Seaver, the great New York Met pitcher. And to help us talk about Tom, his life, his legacy, is the best sports columnist for Newsday. Neil, we appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. In fact, I did an essay last week just about all the prominent sports deaths in 2020. And, you know, I really tried to come up with the ideal lineup of baseball players who died. Mm-hmm. And it would certainly be a World Series favorite going into a season with, obviously the pitching rotation with Seaver, Gibson, and Whitey Ford is a pretty good start. But I mean, it's an amazing roster. It's crazy.
You know, if you had to take a pitching rotation of all timers, you'd be hard pressed to find people who didn't include at least, you know, two of those three: Gibson, Seaver, Ford, somebody in there.
But just how
dominant they were and how impactful they still are within the history of the game.
I know, and then I was like, well, then Don Larson would be good for a spot start in a World Series game, of course. So it's crazy. I mean, I don't want to laugh at these guys passing away. It's really a tribute to just how many great players we lost this year, and you know, especially, I mean, I'm 60, so I didn't see Whitey Ford play, but I saw most of these guys play. You know, even a guy like Al Kaline late in his career, Lou Brock late in his career. So I saw pretty much all of them, not Larson and Ford, but most of them.
And it again, just a year where so many were lost, and it was, one of the things that was more so impactful. One of the things that, and I said this last week when we talked about Whitey Ford's passing on the show, it's one of those things that you almost forget what they meant off the field or some of those other accolades and the type of people they were until they pass. And it's one of those things that, you know, with Tom Seaver is one of those guys, you know, I can remember going, you know, it's still probably going to any Mets game, whether it's home or road, invariably you're going to see at least one 41 jersey in blue and orange pinstripes. I mean, there's a reason he's nicknamed the franchise.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and I'm the perfect age for it. I mean, I feel weird being old enough now so that I have to sort of provide, testimony to people too young to remember these players. But, you know, it is what it is. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, when I was a kid, the people a little bit older than me were all the Mickey Mantle fans. And, of course, I didn't really see Mickey Mantle play. But for my generation, I was at the sweet spot for Seaver. And, you know, even Steve Cohen, who's 4 years older than me, that was his, well, basically he was the favorite player of every person that age who was not a Yankees fan. And he did mean everything for that franchise. He was just this sort of clean cut, you know, guy, and with the attractive wife and the house in the suburbs, and then he comes to this team that was awful, and then he was immediately great, you know, in 67 as a rookie. He was already, you know, people could see he was a major star. And yeah, he was the symbol of that franchise, and as you said, you know, he still is, because the 86 Mets had a lot of memorable characters, obviously, and players revered from it, like, you know, Keith Hernandez and Gooden and Strawberry and Gary Carter, but there wasn't that one player who stood above the rest. And the 69 Mets, you know, really did not have a lot of superstars when you look at their – they had a lot of very good players and good young pitching, obviously, but they didn't have – major national-type stars on that team, really, even today when you look back at the roster. I mean, Nolan Ryan was there, but he was a kid. And Seaver was the guy, period. You know, and he's, and like you said, he still is 51 years later.
It's incredible to watch. And you know, the comparison between the 69, the Miracle Mets, and the 86 Mets, again, you just rattled off multiple names from the 86 team, and maybe this is somewhat recency bias, and there might be more people still around who remember the 86 Mets and remember all of those names. Of course, the way it ended, of course, it probably has a reason to do with that in terms of memorability. But the 69 team, and to go from, you know, an expansion franchise to a World Series team within 3 years is pretty much unheard of in any sport. And you know, 3 years of a rebuilding process is almost unheard of in any sport, even in today's age. But that 69 squad, and as you said, Tom was kind of the one that stood above the rest. But what he meant to that team and how his legacy and his, you know, legend status kind of grew from that year.
Yeah, it's a similar dynamic, obviously, in New York to Joe Namath, because, you know, same thing, where he was kind of this guy who just, you know, came like a it was a tornado of publicity and stuff, and also 50 years later, the Jets haven't even been to a Super Bowl. At least the Mets won another World Series. But it was a similar kind of dynamic where, yeah, he just captured the attention of you know, he, I think another important thing is he was the kind of guy who was revered by young, you know, by kids like me, but also that the middle-aged people could kind of get behind and like and respect, whereas, you know, Joe Namath maybe turned off some of that era's 60-year-olds. It was the kids who liked Joe Namath. But Tom Seaver appealed to everybody. You know, as a personality, which after I got to actually know him a little bit in later years, he was definitely prickly and did not suffer fools gladly. I mean, he was not a you know, an easy guy to get along with for people he worked with. I'm not saying he was a bad guy. He was just a very opinionated guy. And again, he didn't like people who weren't, you know, hardworking, weren't smart, mm-hmm. weren't, you know, he didn't take a lot. He just didn't let things slide. He was a very demanding guy. And obviously that's part of what made him such a great pitcher, because he was stubborn and competitive and all those things you have to be. So yeah, he was the perfect guy to come along. And, you know, with that team, my first year paying attention to them was 69, so I didn't even remember them being terrible. But when you see how that roster was built, even though their records were still bad all through the mid to late 60s, you know, it was coming. It was this, you know, every year they'd add another piece, and Seaver was the biggest one, but there were a lot of others. And then it all just kind of happened all at once. You know, and that has happened other times in baseball history, obviously, where a team, you know, just kind of arrives. But in that era, it was less common just because obviously there was no free agency and, you know, it just mm-hmm. took more time usually for things to happen. So I think I know that in that people were just kind of blown away by how quickly the Mets just were, suddenly a 100-win team. And then even after winning 100 wins, they were a huge underdog to the Orioles in the World Series. And I thought all was lost after Buford led off game one with a home run, but then Seaver lost game one. But of course, the Mets won the next four, and that was it.
It's interesting, and we're talking with Neil Best, sports columnist for Newsday, on the life and legacy of New York Mets pitcher Tom Seaver. It was interesting reading back about him and his career, that and this is what's amazing for Mets fans, and I grew up, my father is still to this day a diehard Mets fan, so I kind of live the heartbreak through him sometimes. This tremendously talented pitcher very easily could have ended up with the Atlanta Braves at the start of his career.
Yeah.
and really just, it's just another one of those things that you look at, and it's one of those near misses in terms of for the Mets that they were on the right side of that time.
Yeah, I think about weird things. I mean, I was thinking about that kind of thing this week when the Jets seem to have lost Trevor Lawrence because of some random game, you know, the meaningless game. And, yeah, how these types of things can change the course of sports history. And, yeah, the Seaver could very easily have been with the Braves. And it was great for New York sports fans, obviously, but also probably for baseball in general because, you know, obviously in that era, the Yankees were kind of carrying the New York market, but to have a National League team here after 4 years where all those National League fans who were used to hating the Yankees had nowhere to go, and then, you know, it took another 7 years for them to be good, you know, the ramifications of that were just huge, just for MLB in general to have a team like a franchise be successful in New York. And obviously, they didn't win another World Series with him, but they, you know, they were good for, you know, another several years. Obviously, they were in the World Series in '73, you know, but and he was good. He kept being good. It wasn't like a flash in the pan, obviously. And then, and even in his later years, I was at Yankee Stadium in 1985 when he won his 300th game for the White Sox, and all the Mets fans went to the game to root against the Yankees because they wanted to see Seaver win his 300th game. So, yeah, he was around a really long time. Mm-hmm. It's just he's so associated with that one team that sometimes you forget how long and successful a career he had. You know, which again is a contrast to a guy like Joe Namath who flamed out very quickly, mostly because of injuries. But Seaver was he was really good for 20 years.
That's the impressive part. 20 years, and that I think not so much impressive in terms of his longevity, but impressive in terms of his impact with the New York Mets, because 20 seasons in Major League Baseball, as you said, his 300th win came with the Chicago White Sox at Yankee Stadium, but 11 of those 20 years spent with the New York Mets, his first 10 with New York, he won all three Cy Youngs there, obviously the World Series, but the Midnight Massacre, as it was known, the trade that sent him to Cincinnati in 77, and then to come back to the Mets for one more year, but after his playing career to get back involved with the Mets in some way, shape, or form, how much did the post-trade Tom Seaver, you know, or how much did the things that went on after that trade in 77 really help solidify and help maybe bring back and ensure that his legacy remains with the New York Mets?
Yeah, I mean, his later years as a player, obviously, it was hard. You know, he was kind of, you know, when he's not playing in New York, he's a little bit out of sight, out of mind, even though that trade, the bitterness from that trade certainly didn't go away. But then after his playing days, you know, he did Mets and Yankees games as an announcer, and he was around and, you know, involved with, you know, whatever, reunions and things like that. So he was there for the last game at Shea, the first game at Citi Field. So the franchise certainly kept him involved. I mean, obviously somewhat selfishly, because they need, you know, I mean, obviously it benefited them to keep him around just because the fans loved seeing him. But, you know, I think he enjoyed it. He threw out the first pitch at the 2013 All-Star game. So until his health started deteriorating, he definitely remained heavily involved. The only downside to that, of course, is that when that happens, and again, I'll use Namath as another example, it sort of indicates that you haven't had any recent successes. So it's great having an iconic mm-hmm. figure still be involved with the franchise, but sometimes you'd like to have fans under 40, you know, have someone they can relate to. So that's sometimes... That's one of the things about 69 that I think about how old... when they had their 50th anniversary stuff last year, and of course Seaver wasn't able to participate, it's like it really, you know, to me, like 25th reunions are kind of nostalgia. 75th reunions are just history. 50th reunions are like a gray area where, you know, you kind of really see how old these guys are and how old you are if you remember the team. And, you know, the 69 Mets have really had not great luck with health, generally speaking. But even the ones who are healthy are, you know, whatever, they're in their mid-70s now. And it's just kind of a really a reality check of how long ago that was. And I see it now with, like, I've noticed, like, when the Yankees do an old-timers game,
right,
and the guys from the 90s get these great ovations, and the guys from the 70s championship teams that I grew up with are like, oh, yeah, who's that old guy? Oh, Reggie Jackson. Oh, yeah, I've heard that name. Yeah, and then you get, like, played applause, like it used to be for DiMaggio or whatever. You know, now it's like they like seeing Paul O'Neill, and they like seeing Derek Jeter, obviously. But, yeah, so the 69 Mets are really old. Just like me.
but again, just tremendous legendary status. And again, a lot of that because of what he did on the field, how he stayed involved off the field, obviously, until his health, as you mentioned, deteriorating, Tom passing away earlier this year, combination of not only COVID-19, but of course, dementia, which he had been suffering for a while. That moment that you know, the 2013 All-Star game, I was fortunate enough to be there, and not as a Mets fan, but to be able to see David Wright with Tom Seaver and all of these things, and that stadium giving him that kind of ovation, that kind of love, you could tell that it was he loves that organization just as much as that organization loved him.
Yeah, and I actually saw, speaking of David Wright, I think it was 2012, so the year before the All-Star game, there was an event at the 92nd Street Y where they had it was like the best player at each position or something like that all time, and Seaver and Wright were both there, and I remember being on the stage afterward waiting to talk to Seaver, and he was just having, you know, he was having his heart-to-heart with David Wright and sharing, you know, just sort of advice and just general sort of bonding, you know, which was kind of cool. I mean, obviously David Wright was kind of the guy at that point. And to see that generational passing of the torch was, and I'm sure David Wright's the kind of guy who I'm sure did appreciate that.
His health, as you mentioned, deteriorating, Tom passing away earlier this year, combination of not only COVID-19, but of course, dementia, which he had been suffering for a while. That moment that the 2013 All-Star game, I was fortunate enough to be there, and not as a Mets fan, but to be able to see David Wright with Tom Seaver and all of these things, and that stadium giving him that kind of ovation, that kind of love, you could tell that it was he loves that organization just as much as that organization loved him.
Yeah, and I actually saw, speaking of David Wright, I think it was 2012, so the year before the All-Star game, there was an event at the 92nd Street Y where they had it was like the best player at each position or something like that all time, and Seaver and Wright were both there, and I remember being on the stage afterward waiting to talk to Seaver, and he was just having, you know, he was having his heart-to-heart with David Wright and sharing, you know, just sort of advice and just general sort of bonding. You know, which was kind of cool. I mean, obviously, David Wright was kind of the guy at that point, and to see that generational passing of the torch was, and I'm sure David Wright's the kind of guy who I'm sure did appreciate that. He definitely he cared, and he wanted the Mets to be good, and you know, even if they usually weren't, he was rooting for them. There's no question about that. Well, him as a player that I think is also interesting to me is that these days, obviously, we're used to the fact that, you know, there's 18 strikeouts a game or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, the strikeout totals, given his era, you know, the fact that he struck out 10 guys in a row in this era doesn't seem that crazy. But back then, yeah, there were some strikeout pitchers, obviously, but it just wasn't as common to just have huge strikeout totals. And some of his numbers are just crazy. Like I said, just even more so given the era it was, when people actually, when batters actually didn't like to strike out. So it's, you know, it's different now, obviously.
Crazy how times have changed. He's sixth all-time in strikeouts, 3,640. And just one of only two pitchers with 300 wins, 3,000 strikeouts, and a career ERA under 3. The only other one being Walter Johnson. So, again, just incredibly talented, incredibly dominant for him. One of the things that I always find interesting about players in general is what they do post-playing career. We talked about Tom and his broadcasting. Some players go broadcasting, some players go coaching, some players just kind of go away. But Tom really had an affinity for wine and getting involved in that and had his own vineyard. I mean, and maybe it's from growing up in California, but, you know, his post-playing career and that side of things, spending time, obviously, with his wife, Nancy, and whatnot. But as he got into that older age and as he kind of went away from being everyday baseball related, what kind of things and how much, you know, I guess fun was Tom having in those other avenues?
Well, yeah, I mean, I always got the sense that the broadcasting was something he just kind of dabbled in. I mean, you're right, the wine thing is obviously was by far and away his number one passion post-playing, and I guess it started when he was still playing, but yeah, he took it very seriously because he didn't want it to be just, you know, he didn't want it to be some, like, hobby. He wanted it to be serious, which it was, and I, you know, I'm no wine expert, but I gather his wine is respected, and you know, he wasn't just, oh, I'm going to slap my name, you know, my name on a label and be done with it. He took it seriously, and, you know, I also think in terms of his involvement with stuff like broadcasting or just going to Mets reunions or whatever, you know, I think he loved his, you know, California home so much that, you know, just geographically, he got to be isolated and do his thing out there instead of being, you know, living in suburban New York or something and being expected to show up for things all the time. So I do think his little isolated world out there in his vineyard was also something he liked about the wine business, was just the, you know, the atmosphere of it. And being away from New York, where people, I mean, I'm sure people in Northern California know who Tom Seaver is, but it's not, you know, it's not the same as being in New York and constantly being Tom Seaver, you know.
Yeah, 100%. One of the things, last thing before I let you know, we're talking with Neil Best, sports columnist for Newsday here. This was a year, and I always think about this when a, you know, athlete, celebrity in some way, shape, or form, you know, someone of that stature passes away, and it's not just, it's interesting, it's not just the family that grieves, it's an entire fan base that grieves with someone. And I remember specifically, you know, the one that maybe hit me the most, which was surprising because I'm not a Lakers fan, was Kobe Bryant, and a lot of that being his age having something to do with it. But to have those mass gatherings, those memorials that the fans can attend, that the, you know, they can have that kind of grieving process, whatever it is, didn't get to happen this year. Obviously, fans not allowed in ballparks, but hopefully 2021 allows an opportunity for that to happen at Citi Field in Queens with that number 41. What do you expect, or what would you think the scene would be like when the Mets can have their Tom Seaver Day with their fans and allow those people to all gather together and remember and memorialize Tom Terrific?
Well, first of all, yeah, obviously it'll be a special event and people will appreciate it, and it should happen. Like you said, people didn't get those opportunities this year. You know, the only thing that I would say, like I was kind of alluded to earlier, it's a different feel when a guy of that, not that he was, you know, 90 years old, but I think it'll be more of an appreciation instead of like an emotional outpouring. Like, you know, when a guy like, you know, when Thurman Munson died or Kobe, like you mentioned, these shocking sudden deaths of young players is a different feel. It's more, you know, it's more just shock and emotion. I think with a guy like Seaver, it's going to be more appreciation. And yeah, obviously, if you're a younger Mets fan, one would hope that you realize what he meant and kind of give him that appreciation. It's just a less, you know, it's a less emotional thing because of just the generational part. But even 25-year-old Mets fans obviously understand what this guy meant, even today. And I know they appreciate him.
He's Neil Best, sports columnist for Newsday. Neil, we appreciate the time. Thank you so much. Happy holidays, and hopefully we get back into a baseball stadium with full crowds in 2021.
Yes, that would be good. all right, thanks for having me.
That's Neil Best, sports columnist for Newsday. You can follow him on Twitter at SportsWatch. And if you ever wondered how much a legacy a guy who, you know, for you younger listeners that maybe didn't realize or don't know what Tom Seaver meant, think about this. Tom Brady tried to trademark Tom Terrific in 2019, and the U.S. Trademark and Patent Office said no because it could imply a relationship with Tom Seaver. That's how impactful that man was, not just for the New York Mets, but for baseball and for sports as a whole. We appreciate Neil's time. We appreciate your guys' time and listening. Our final show of 2020, we'll be back better than ever on January 7th with brand new shows as we head into a brand new calendar year. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, review, share us with your friends and family wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on social media. Just search Caught Listening by Public House Media on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you want us to talk about on the show. And until next year, I'm Christian Heimel. You have been Caught Listening.
Me, but also you. The Pharaoh fast forwards his favorite foreign film, Powder Donut. Okay, what's my line?
The only line I see here on the script is get options based on your budget with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive.
Oh man, that's a tongue twister, huh? I'm sorry, I'm gonna need a few more minutes. Bulbous Walrus, the Bulbous Walrus.
The Name Your Price tool, only from Progressive.
The owl ran afoul of the comatose coxswain.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.